The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the Transmission of Light, Case 34, Huainong. Huainong worked in the mill at Huangmei, where the Zen master Hongren was teaching. One night, the Zen master came to the mill and asked Huainong, "Is the rice clean yet?" Huainong said, "It's clean, but hasn't been sifted." The Zen master knocked the mortar 3 times with his staff. Huainong shook rice in a sieve 3 times and entered the Zen master's room. Kazan's verse. Knocking the mortar, the sound is high beyond the sky. Sifting in the clouds, the bright moon is clear deep in the night. So I mentioned yesterday that I wanted to spend a few talks on transmission and lineage and its importance within our tradition, both within the Buddhist tradition and in our own tradition of Zen. This is drawn from Kazan, who was several generations after Dogen. He compiled this collection of koans that are presented as the enlightenment experiences of our lineage, beginning with the Buddha and leading down to, I think, Ajo, one of Dogen's successors. And I said yesterday that I wanted to use Huainong as an example of an historical example of transmission and lineage, also because he's a very important figure within our tradition. Which is interesting also because although he's clearly an historical figure, there's a lot of questions about the history that has been told about him and how it's come down to us. In Dogen's fascicle, Menju on Face-to-Face Transmission, Dogen said, "At the time of bowing formally to Shakyamuni Buddha's face, the 51 Buddha ancestors and the 7 original Buddhas are not present side by side or in a line, but it is face-to-face transmission among all the Buddha ancestors at the same time. If you don't see in just one generation all of the masters, then you're not yet fully a disciple. If you don't see in just one generation all the disciples, then you're not yet fully a master. Masters and disciples always see one another when transmitting and receiving the Dharma. This is the realization of the way, face-to-face transmission of the ancestral source. Thus, masters and disciples bring forth the luminous face of the Tathagata." And I spoke a little bit yesterday about how, you know, in our time, how quickly things move because of technology, because of the whole thing. And that in that, Buddhism, from one perspective, you could say, is evolving very quickly within the West, right? They're unprecedented. With the internet, it's possible to basically have access to all the different traditions, teachings that for thousands of years you could only have if you were in the presence of a teacher. Teachings that would have considered that were considered secret in the sense that they could only be given under certain circumstances and that are now being made available. Texts and books and scholarship and all of the rest. And so, you know, in one sense, from one perspective, that just seems like, you know, an amazing availability and access to the Dharma, which it is in many ways. But the question I raise is, but as that is happening, what else is happening? You know, if you think of Buddhism evolving, it's sort of like if you, you know, if you were born and you're sort of a little toddler, you know, or just a young child, and then suddenly, boop, you know, within a matter of weeks, you're living in an adult body. So you're living in an adult body, but you're not an adult yet, right? Because there are certain things that can only happen in time and happen actually in sort of mutuality with the development of the body, right? It's all happening together. And so what does that mean for us? And some of the most difficult aspects of our practice, those things which happen face to face, those things which happen in time, you know, in our sort of experience-driven culture where we think, if I just have a good experience, you know, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, that's together, that's what makes a good life. And so then, and now it's like, oh, Buddhism. So now it's, here's a like a bonanza of good experiences, right? Enlightenment experiences. So if I just get a bunch of those, or maybe just one good one, right? And it's, so it's like, and koan training can be part of that whole delusion. It's like, if I just see a koan, if I just have some insight, without understanding that that happens in concert with everything else that is happening. It can't be divorced. And so then what does that mean in terms of some of those most difficult, subtle, profound aspects of the tradition that take time and careful attention and study face to face? We communicate with words, with gestures, with facial expressions in our body, with our energy. We express what we think, what we feel, what we want, our loves, our hates. We receive communications, we give them out. Some of them we're aware of, some of them we're not. We seek out things that are familiar and similar. We often shy away from or distrust things that appear different. And all of it's going through our mind. All of it's going through our deep web of associative thinking, of history, of karma, of endless, infinite experiences that we've had that have all been sort of integrated into our deepest consciousness that become the consciousness through which we look and hear and taste and touch and think. Is there direct contact? Is there direct communication that is free of desire and expectation, is not bound in trying to get what we want, that is free of words and meaning and is somehow understood with the whole body and mind, a different kind of understanding? I was reading an article by Rebecca Solnit, and she was saying, she's talking about contemporary right-wing ideology. Perhaps the same thing exists on contemporary left-wing ideology too. But it's something that I think we can all relate to, particularly as Westerners, particularly as Americans, because it's sort of, she's speaking to our sort of one of our core narratives. She said, if you boil it all down, it's a kind of soup, a kind of bouillon cube. And the idea that things are not connected to other things, that people are not connected to other people, and that we're all better off unconnected. Core values are individual freedom, individual responsibility, yourself for yourself on your own. And out of this glorious disconnect comes all sorts of illogical thinking, but logical from within that view. Taken to its conclusion, this worldview dictates that even facts are freestanding items that the self-made man can manufacture for use as he sees fit. And she's intentionally using the male pronoun here. She says, the cowboy is the American embodiment of this ideology of isolation. Though the archetype of the self-reliant individual, I did it on my own, has its roots less in actual American history than in the imagined history of the Cold War era Westerns. She likens, she says, the American West was indigenous land, given to settlers by the U.S. government and cleared for them by the U.S. Army, crisscrossed by government-subsidized railroads, full of water projects and other enormous cooperative enterprises. She says, but all this has very little to do with Shane and the sheriff at High Noon, or the man with no name in Sergio Leone's Spaghetti Western Trilogy, which I was raised on. Mm-hmm. Those were our, for me and my male friends, those were our, that was what cool was. Don't sweat. Definitely don't cry. Don't ask for help. Go it alone. She says, but never mind that, because a cowboy silhouetted against the sunset looks so good, whether he's Ronald Reagan or the Marlboro Man. The loner taketh not, nor does he give. He scorneth the social and relies on himself alone. Interesting to even think of the idea of individual freedom. Is there such a thing? Does that even exist? If it's individual, in the way that she's describing this disconnect, this glorious disconnect, which is essentially, she's really describing sort of the, we could say, an extreme view, or maybe the logical extension of just the sense of self within a culture which is based in a narrative such as she's describing, right? Of the individual, where the individual is supreme. If it is just an individual, yourself for yourself on your own, is that freedom? If it's true freedom, can it be just individual? From a Buddhist perspective, this is delusion, which means it's suffering. The Buddha said, between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. It said that he uttered those words upon his own enlightenment. And that can sound like an extreme kind of egoism, but it is, when we hear it from a position of isolation or individuality, that's what it sounds like. And that either sounds great, it's like, oh, I want to be that one. I want to be all alone and the honored one. But of course, that's not what he's saying. What is communicated and expressed, what is communicated and expressed when inside and outside cannot be found, are not divided, when there is not a single one, then there is only I alone and the honored one. This is why Buddhist teachings, I think, are kind of important for us. Whether they come via Buddhism, or they come, take them any way you can get them. This medicine, this remedy for this sense of extreme isolation, which seems very clearly to go hand in hand together with our unhappiness, with the deep illness of our time and our culture. I mean, that we can be seeing this and deny those connections. The fact that, you know, you can't necessarily draw a direct causal link from this to that means everything continues to be up for grabs. There are no facts. There's nothing that we can definitively choose. Maybe we should do another study, another report, get more information, come back in 5 years, tell us what you found. From a Buddhist understanding of karma, that is just not necessary. It is clear, the link, the causal link. The story of Huai Nung is important for what it communicates, not so much for its detail by detail connection to or veracity in terms of history. It's said that the Platform Sutra, which is a sutra of the sixth ancestor, Huainung, that his prominence as a figure might have actually come about because of his successor, who wanted to elevate himself and his position, but couldn't do that by saying, look at me, but could do that by saying, look at my teacher, right? If you have excellent parents, well, then you must be made of the same stuff. And so that's what scholars believe is sort of how this came about. And this was also during a whole period of a kind of contrived debate between sudden and gradual enlightenment. And there was a lot of politics, basically, in terms of, you know, different lineages or sects vying for credibility and attention and so on. But in the Platform Sutra, his biography, his father died when he was quite young. He lived with his mother. They were very poor. He collected firewood and sold it in the marketplace. And one day, he was in a shop, and he heard a customer come in chanting the Diamond Sutra. Wouldn't that be nice if you were like Kmart, and somebody just walked by chanting the Diamond Sutra? You might want to live there. Go live in that place. And so he was taken, shaken, by hearing those words. And he went up to the person and said, what are you chanting? Where did you hear this? And he said, oh, don't you know, this is the Diamond Sutra. I was visiting the master, the abbot of South Mountain, or East Mountain, which was one of the great training centers at that time. And he was teaching. Hong Ran was the abbot. He was teaching on the Diamond Sutra. And Huainong said, as soon as I heard this, I felt drawn as if by something from a past life. Drawn in a way that's almost inexplicable, but drawn. And so he said goodbye to his mother, and there are different accounts of how that actually transpired. One is he just left. Another is he went to a family friend and said, well, ensured that his mother would be taken care of. Let's choose that one. Okay. And then he goes to the fifth ancestor, and so he's poor, he's a layman, he also turns out he's illiterate, not a Buddhist. He has none of the stuff, he has none of the credentials, at a time when those things mattered. And they always matter in society, most societies, but they also mattered in Buddhism. Certainly at this monastery. And so he comes with none of those. So he's an outsider. He comes from a part of China which was considered not sophisticated. And so he goes to Hongren and asks to meet him. And Hongren says, where are you from? And what exactly do you hope to get from me by coming to this place and paying your respects? And Huainong said, your disciple is from Lingyan. I'm a commoner. And the reason I came all this way to pay my respects is I want to be a Buddha. I don't want anything else. And the master scoffed and says, but you're from Lingyan. You're a jungle rat. You're a nobody. Right? How can you possibly be a Buddha? Huainong said, people come from the north or the south, but their Buddha nature doesn't. He said, the lives of this jungle rat and the master's aren't the same, but how can our Buddha nature differ? And so I said, the master was about to say something, but he noticed that an attendant was standing nearby, and so he kept quiet. And he sent Huainong to work. And so he worked as a rice miller. And he did this for 8 months. And so he was not allowed into the training hall. Right? And so this is part of the story, right? That he didn't have any of the credentials. And so what is this saying? Why is this held up? Because very often great masters come from well-off, well-placed families. And in traditional Buddhism, that's seen as an indication of their karma, that if you have lived well and sort of been developing yourself along the path in a past life, you will be well-born in this life. And that's often framed in terms of having financial means. And so that's not always true, but it's often the case. And so, beginning with the Buddha. And so here's someone who doesn't fit any of those qualifications. He's not a monk, which means he has really no credibility, right? Probably wouldn't even be allowed into the training hall. Illiterate and so on. And so he's not allowed in, but he's not sent away. And so it said that Hongren, after a while, called all of his disciples together and said, look, all of you have been, you've come here saying that you have the greatest concern for life and death, but you spend your day making offerings and lurking for ways to reap merit. You're not really addressing the fundamental matter. So he said, go back to your rooms and write a poem expressing your understanding, and whoever is the clearest, I will transmit the robe and the bowl of Bodhidharma. So the tradition is that Bodhidharma, having come from India, having transmitted to his first disciple, Hueka, transmitted his own robe, his okesa, and his wariyoki bowl as a symbol of the transmission. And so that has been passed down to Hongren, and so Hongren is saying, whoever is the most clear, I will transmit. Maybe he was getting to the end of his life. I don't know why he would have done it in this way, or if that's just the story. It's not so important. So all the disciples go back to their rooms, talk amongst themselves, and realize that the chief disciple, Shin Hur, is clearly the contender, right? He's basically the assistant teacher. Nobody else is even going to try, because clearly this disciple is the successor. Meanwhile, the successor is worrying about, should I write a poem? If I write a poem, it's going to look like I want the transmission. That's not proper. But if I don't write a poem, then my teacher won't understand me and I won't see if I'm clear. And he's sort of in this dilemma. What a predicament, it says. Finally, he writes the poem, but he puts it up at midnight so nobody knows that it's his. And he says, I'll just wait and see what happens. And so the next day, it's seen, the Hongren comes and offers incense and says, and the poem is, the body is a Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. And so the Hongren called all the disciples together and said, if you recite and understand this gatha, you will see your nature. Practice this. Anyone who relies on this for a teaching will not regress. And then he sent everybody away. And then he calls his disciple who wrote the poem to his room and said, did you write this? And he said, I'm guilty. It's true. I was the one who wrote it. But I don't dare ask for the robe and the bowl, only for your consideration as to whether this disciple has acquired enough wisdom to understand what is truly important or not. So there's it is not proper to ask, to seek for the robe and the bowl. There's a fascicle piece in Zwi Monkey where Dido, not he would have done it too, but Dogen takes to task one of his students who's asking to be the chief disciple. And he's basically saying, don't do that, right? In other words, he's doubting the motives for wanting to do that. You know, why would you ask to do this other than because you see this as status or a symbol of something or et cetera? So, you know, it's materialistic. It's ego. And so Hongren says, this poem of yours shows your understanding has only reached the threshold, but you have not yet entered the room. If ordinary people use your teaching, they won't regress. But someone with such an understanding who seeks perfect enlightenment will not realize it. Go back to your room, practice more, look deeply for a few days, and write another poem. If you're able to enter the door and see your nature, I will give you the robe and the bowl. Now, meanwhile, you know, there's scuttlebutt because everybody's all jazzed up about this poem that's been written and what's going on. And And so a novice walks by the milling room where Huainong is busily milling the rice, unaware of all of this. And he hears the poem and he goes, "What's that? What are you chanting?" And the novice says, "Don't you know?" And he tells him the whole story and recites him the poem. And Huainong says, "I've been treading this mill more than 8 months, but I've never been to that, to the ancestors' hall where the poem is hung. Could you take me there and show it to me?" So he takes him there, and Huainong does bows to the poem and offers incense. And then he said, once he heard it, so he asked him to read it again. He said, "Once I heard it, I understood what was truly important, and I composed my own gatha," because he realized that this gatha was not very clear. This poem was not very clear. The person who wrote it was not very clear. He said, "But I didn't know how to write, so I asked someone to write it for me on the wall." Now, of course, what this is communicating is that someone can be deeply enlightened and not be literate and not know a lot about Buddhism and not have all of that stuff. In other words, that's not what it's reliant upon. That's the important, one of the important things of this teaching. Right? Because those are the things, those are sort of that's the currency that usually leads to success in life, right? Having knowledge and intellect and being able to articulate it and, you know, to work within those worlds. And so we naturally can think that, well, that's the same stuff. It worked out there. It's going to work here. And so this is a teaching to say, no, that there's nothing inherently wrong with any of that, but that's not the basis of this. There's something else going on. And so Huainong's poem was, "Bodhi is essentially not a tree, and the clear mirror is not a stand. Fundamentally, there is not a single thing. Where could the dust collect?" And when everyone saw this poem, they were dumbfounded. And they wanted to know, where did this come from? Who did this? And so Hongren, the teacher, comes and looks at it and said, "Whoever wrote this doesn't understand." He dismissed it. And then in the middle of the night, he comes to the room where Huainong is and transmit the Dharma to him. And that's what this koan is. Is the rice clean yet? It's clean, but not sifted. And he knocks the mortar 3 times. And Huainong responds by shifting the sieve. Shh, shh, shh. What is that communication? What are they communicating? So Huainong is being held up that it is not about being in a group, and that even Hongren saw Huainong. He saw his Dharma understanding, but he still saw him as an outsider. He didn't let that get in the way, but he didn't invite him in. It's presented later as though that would cause havoc within the monastery. Sometimes that's necessary. But what is that exchange? What is that communication? He shook the sieve 3 times and entered the master's room. Mind-to-mind meeting. Knocking the mortar, the sound is high, beyond the sky, heard throughout the world. Sifting in the clouds, the bright moon is clear, and deep in the night, everything is revealed. You know, in any endeavor, in any field where you go in deeply, when you meet someone who has mastery, who is skilled within that field, you recognize him, you share a language. And oftentimes that's language, but it's more than that. You can see it in the way they handle an instrument or tools. You can see it in the way they handle themselves, in terms of there's a common experience that when we sit together in silence for a whole week, there is something, some understandings that we come together. I remember when my brother many, many years ago became a Sikh formally, and he visited my family for the first time since he had become a Sikh, and my mother was asking him some questions, and at one point he said, "Mom, I can't really explain this to you because you're not part of this tradition." And I saw the look on her face. You know, she felt shut out. And later I was talking to him. I said, "Dude," I said, "why did you say that?" And he goes, "Because it's true." And I said, "I know it's true, but it's hurtful to say it that way, you know. It feels excluded." Both are true, right? That there is an understanding, there is a communication that can only be understood by people who are walking the same path, drinking the same water, sitting on the same seat. And for us, that has absolutely nothing to do with exclusion. I mean, that's the seat we're sitting on. Everyone's there. Many who are there don't know it, that they're there. But that doesn't mean they're not there. When all sense of self and other, before and after meaning and significance, rank, position, and title can't be found, what remains? Dada Roshi used to say, he would ask that question often, when everything is dropped away, what remains? Everything. Everything remains. But what is this everything? Almost always when people are working on Mu at some point, they will say, "It's everything." And I will say, "What is this everything?" Because everything is a word. You're making a sound with your mouth. But what is that? Until we see it, we can't live by it, even though we're living nothing but it in every moment. The Buddha said, "Through countless births in the cycle of existence, I have run, not finding, although seeking, the builder of this house. And again, I face the suffering of new birth, of more suffering, of another day, of more confusion, of another cycle repeating itself." And he said, "But oh, house builder, now you are seen. You shall not build this house again for me. All of your beams are broken. The ridgepole is shattered. The mind is free from conditioning. The end of craving has been reached." How to speak of it? What is important, what was important that no doubt Hongren saw in Hui Nung was the sincerity in his heart. It wasn't just that he had some insight, but he saw the deep sincerity in his heart. Having traveled all this way, if we take the story just at face value, as it's being presented, and he's sent to this shop to work while everybody else is doing the important stuff. And he bows and he serves. Not only because he is sincere, but because he understands, he knows. Not that just what Hongren is doing, but he knows his mind. He understands who is the master, who is the house builder. Having intellectual knowledge is not inherently an obstacle, but because of the way we use our minds and rely on them so heavily, and solve all of our problems, or so many of them, with our intellect, naturally encountering the problem of delusion, we will want to figure it out. And being intellectual doesn't mean, you know, having a lot of degrees or being a sophisticated thinker. It just means experiencing things as objects, naming them, describing them, knowing them through those descriptions. It means experiencing things through our conceptual mind. The conceptual mind isn't always thinking, but it's always conceptualizing, as long as it's based in duality. And we intellectualize everything, life, love, our suffering. Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? This isn't fair. This shouldn't be happening. You might be right. It's not fair and it shouldn't be happening. But if it is happening, that's the reality before your eyes. And so we think about it, we talk about it, we write songs about it, books about it. We create formulas, we categorize, we make indexes. It's like building rooms in a house, and each room is defined by its walls. There's a door to get in, there's a door to get out. When you go into this room, you meditate. When you go into this room, you sleep. Maybe you have sex. When you go into this room, you pee or you defecate. You take a shower. When you go to this room, you hang out. You relax. This room, you make your meals. Each room is divided, cut off. It's got its own purpose for its own reason. It's got its own identity. And if those proliferate, we have to create more rooms, or maybe we get a shed, right? So we keep everything organized. It's the meaning that we give to each of those rooms that transforms them in our mind to places of pain, of pleasure, of freedom, of entrapment, of practice or not practice, right? So we go into a room to meditate. This is where practice happens, and then you leave the room. Okay, you've just left the room where practice happens. Now what? So we should see how that's just not going to work, right? Henung's Huenung said, good friends, this Dharma teaching of mine, now this is after this is more towards the end of the story. This Dharma teaching of mine is based on meditation and wisdom, but don't make the mistake of thinking that meditation and wisdom are separate. They are of one essence, not two. Meditation is the body of wisdom. Wisdom is the function of meditation. And here by wisdom, because of the way he's speaking of it, I understand this as we understand wisdom and compassion merged, unified, as they naturally and essentially are. So don't think of wisdom as just understanding, but think of it as also manifesting that as compassion. Wherever you find wisdom, you will find meditation. And wherever you find meditation, you will find wisdom. Good friends, what this means is that meditation and wisdom are one. Which means when we're thinking about Zazen, we should also understand that we're at the same time we're reflecting on what is wisdom and compassion. When we're thinking of compassion, of being compassionate, acting compassionately, we should also know that we're thinking about and we're bringing forth Zazen, meditation. Whether we're on the cushion or not is just a matter of where we happen to be in that moment. He says, be careful. Don't think that meditation comes first and then we gain wisdom. Or that wisdom comes first and then we will be able to meditate. For those who hold such views, the Dharma is dualistic. It's like speaking good words, but your mind is not good. He describes this as one practice samadhi. And again, samadhi here I would not think as separated from insight, from understanding. This is not just being in a state of no thought, or not necessarily even being without thought. He says it means at all times, walking, standing, sitting, lying down, always practicing with a straightforward mind. The Vimalakirti Sutra says a straightforward mind is the place of enlightenment. Don't practice hypocrisy with your mind while you talk about being straightforward with your mouth. In other words, unify, integrate, harmonize. And so in that house that we build, we practice bringing down the walls. Or you could say, just go into one room and make that the whole house. And then as we do that, more and more we begin to see that there aren't any walls at all, actually. We use them in the beginning because it's familiar territory. And so as we're beginning to imagine the possibility and practice on the basis of the fact that we are not here on our own. We are not just yourself for yourself on your own, which is radical and revolutionary. Even if we believe that is not true, we have been taught and conditioned to know that that is true. And our senses seem to verify that. You are there, I am here. And so in a sense, we use those walls. We use this space. And that's why it's important, actually, to regard it as a sacred space. That we practice silence within this space. That we don't use this, right? We use this for very particular practices, right? And that we do that intentionally, right? To help create a sense so we can begin to understand what it is to be in a sacred space that is devoted, right? So that the association begins to be, when we enter into that space, something begins to happen. Something is being transmitted between ourselves and this space. And we're all part of making that happen. And the instruments are part of that. And the altar, how we take care of it, straightening it up, cleaning it, all of these things are part of that. And in a sense, we're constructing this, right? There would be nothing inherently wrong with doing other things in this room, like having a dance party, right? Dancing is not evil, right? Why don't we do that in this space? That would be a more advanced practice for everyone, including myself. Because it helps us to sort of work with those walls that are already existing in our mind and begin to use them differently. Use them in a way that it seems narrow and focused in the moment. But then as we enter into that room, we begin to see, oh, wait a minute. This is much, much larger. Like when you enter into the breath and you think it's just the breath, like what's the deal? But then when you actually are doing Zazen, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Or you sit on that seat and you think it's just you. Why are you having to do this? Why doesn't anybody help you out? Why are you having to do this on your own? And then when you really sit on that seat, you think, what was I thinking? I have never been alone. And at the same time, those walls are coming down. And we realize, oh, they were useful. But I don't need them anymore. This house will not be built again. Huenong said, the way has to flow freely. Why block it up? The way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on any dharma. As soon as it dwells on a single thing, it becomes bound. And when that thing is small, it's bound in a small way, but it's bound. When it's bound on something big, it's bound in a big way. And we see that the more we are bound, the more frenzied we become and the more dangerous we become. You know, it's like if you look at, I've looked at the videos, you know, of the rebellion, the attack on January 6th in Washington, and just studying, just looking at faces, at people, our people, our siblings, our friends, our neighbors, our human beings, us, and just looking and listening to the words and seeing, and to see the what happens when it's built up and built up, and it's all this collective thing that's happening. It's the tribe, right? Which can bring unimaginable peace and joy and love, and it can also bring destruction. Because in both cases, what comes out is something becomes larger. And when that is based in anger and hatred and delusion and ignorance, that which is part of no one person but becomes something much larger is that magnified. Just as is when a group of people comes together in loving kindness and compassion and gladness and equanimity, and we work with vigor and sincerity, that which comes forth is magnified. It's the same forces. Just shifted, enlightened, illuminated, relieved of their burden. The power of that. Of the way being blocked up, of dwelling in something and it becoming bound and bound and bound and bound. Such that what seems right and logical is destruction. That's how we give life. That's how we liberate. As an old master said, Ching Ching, we follow, the world becomes upside down. We follow after things and lose ourselves. And when we are lost ourselves, we lose others with us. We lose each other together. But when the way is not blocked up, we find ourselves by letting that house builder build no more. And we find each other. And we do that together. Same workings. You know, the Buddha said, I'm paraphrasing. He said, if sentient beings could see the world the way I do, then they would never take a bite of food without first feeding others. And I think if we could see the world the way our mind, our original mind, is the world, sees the world, knows the world already, if we can, the more and more we can see the world from an enlightened view, from a liberated view, at every step along the way, then we would never not have faith. We would never lose our faith. Not just in ourselves and the Dharma, but in each other. Because we would see so clearly who we are as human beings, what this world is, as an altar. And thank goodness that even within, you know, our being bound, we have glimpses. We get glimpses. That for those of us who begin seeking are enough. In a sense, you only need a glimpse. You only need a moment that happens at the right time of ripeness when you are ready. Because we're getting them all the time, but we're not ready yet. We're not interested. We're not hearing until we are. For Hui Nong, it was hearing the Diamond Sutra at just that moment. Nobody can predict that. Nobody can know that. And what were the forces that were happening in his life that made him ripe at that moment to have been so deeply entered by those words? Thank goodness for that. So, okay. Huainong said, I have come here today because I have a connection of many lifetimes with you. Yes, this seems so. This seems so.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.